This is Channel 2 over, and Suzanne reports her second session this Thursday, the 5th of August, 71. Now, this is Suzanne Report, Channel 2 over, from 1 to around 800, I suppose, this Thursday, the 5th of August, 71, and this is her second session. The barber tape seemed a little...
Well, I tell you, it's not... Miss Mary, you know, like I said to you, there's no, none of that hesitation, the you knows and the ands and the ers and the... and Barbara's, you know, I guess she's pretty vocal, and but it just doesn't sound quite like the freedom that Miss Mary's got with her language. That's the same. I expect the same trouble I have. Compared to Miss Mary, it sounds to me like I'm pretty flat. It's just, I don't know exactly. It just
well, you're sort of derivative, and she's sort of a native product, you know.
Yeah.
That's right. She is the voice.
Yeah. You see, that's what perks me up. I go out on my rounds, or else I would just, I couldn't stand it up there at the campus, you see.
Yeah, it's just a, well,
I like that category. They're derivatives. That's right, we are.
I mean, when I guess I get a little bit of it from Barbara, but mostly when I report now, I have Miss Mary in mind and Mr. Weaver in mind.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is it's a little bit that Barbara's tapes just seem just a little flat. And after I've listened to him a while, then I start getting interested in him.
Yes, yes.
But I think it's mainly that I don't really know exactly where I'm going with them. You know, I think, well, I'll take the best ones and do something with them, but I think, what am I going to do with them? You know, do I just say, well, she starts out here and she goes to here? You know. You listen to a tape, and you seem like you know right off where the high point is. And I may listen a while, but
I don't know anything right off.
It seems that way.
Everything I do it the hard way.
But I, you know, I'm kind of getting, I guess it's a, let's see. I wrote it out when I was eating breakfast this morning. I don't know if I remember. Is that in my reading of Twain and all helps me to listen to Mr. Weaver and Miss Mary. But listening to them and their experience, it opens up the literature, so it just keeps going back and forth, kind of, you know. The one makes the other, you know, they open each other up. And Barbara, I guess, you know, maybe I want her to do more than what she already is doing, and she's doing a lot, you know. You keep saying, well, you know, if she'd done it this way, or she filled this in, or something like that.
Well,
I think I keep wanting her to be literary, which is just exactly the wrong kind of thing.
Well, now you see, that's right. That's sports, to get into Mr. Weaver. Now you see what I do. It bore me to death to go to the movie, Suzanne. You see, if I need a little pickup, all I've got to do is talk to Mr. Weaver for 30 minutes and come home and work it out. Now, not enough just talk to him. I gotta come back and look at it on paper. Now, some people might not need the paper, but I have to have it. And it's just perfect and delightful on paper. As I put it on paper, I can see it so much clearer than I did when I talked to him. Now, if I had it all on tape, you see, I could see it even better. But a lot of you can't have everything on tape. Oh, that picks me up. You see, huh?
It does me too. I mean, that's. I think that's why I'd rather spend more time out here than listen to the tape and down. Of course, the movies. You know, it's not that I particularly care about them that much. You know, Jim, you gotta do stuff with him. And he could. I figured it was long as I'm there. Enjoy the popcorn. But I think part of the thing is, right now, Mr. Weaver and Miss Ferry are so delightful just, you know, to listen to them. And I do now. I go home and put it on paper, and I like that too. And Jim says, well, what do you do that for? I said, Jim, I've written more this summer than I ever have, you know, in any term of the class. He says, but all you do is go home and write what they say. That makes no sense. He said, there you've been. You've been playing around all summer. I said, well. And it's like that kind of, you know. I mean, it's fun. It's a lot more fun than what he's doing, anyway.
You see it a lot.
But,
now, I went over the other morning. I went over to see Shirley because I hadn't seen her for a month.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'll be darned. You know, I'll be darned. I came home, spent the rest of the day on that little visit, and it wasn't a visit. She was out there selling cans and came in. I leaned on the car and watched them. I didn't want to get into the business side of it, you
mm-hmm.
see. I didn't want to. The adjustment is too delicate for that. And we went in and had a pink aide and sat on the porch, and she walked out the car with me. One thing, she reported on Miss Gussie. And I'm lacking in that. I don't have anyone to report on things. You see, I feel like Faulkner, most of the things that he put into the Hamlet, he's not rattling with himself. He's listened to the reports.
Mm-hmm.
He has so much of it, see. I don't have access to that. And where I go, I can't hear that sort of talk. It's not that kind of talk, and I don't have any control of it whatever. It's all at loose ends, you see. Where I go, yes, I just spent the rest of the day on that little visit, and it's perfectly charming. Now that's what I did on Miss Daisy's tape yesterday. And I thought it was so worthless. I was apologetic about it. She had no vigor. She's facing sickness. Back over that thing, and it's just magic. Just perfectly magic.
You suppose Suzanne would be happier working with Mr. Weaver?
Well, she'd let her. I don't know for you. You can't work with Mr. Weaver.
No, it's not that. I think the tapes, I listen to a tape and I just sit there and my mind goes blank is what it happens. And I can transcribe it and I can say, well, I can say little things about it, but I don't feel like I'm actually handling it at all.
But there's a tape.
Yeah, the tape.
You need to listen to it too.
Yeah, I think so. Well,
You know, it occurs to me it could be she needs to talk about it.
You can do that.
Well, I mean, you know, you think you can't, but what I mean, yeah, you know, that all yeah, of us have been in on the Barbara tape, and things come to you if you talk a little bit.
Yes, that's right.
About
Patty.
It, and I don't believe you can sit and just will the thing to come.
No, now you see.
Wait, you see, that's why it's not just talking it over with you because you know it, but it helps me. It doesn't matter who I'm talking to if they'll just listen to me talk it out.
Uh-huh. That's what I'm thinking about.
And of course, you know, Jim's, he'll listen for a while. It's not that he's just that he's got so much else on his mind.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And all my friends are gone this summer.
Yeah.
And of course, now Ann, she's not working. What I'd do is just have her come over and sit there and listen. You know,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if she's not, doesn't look at it the same way I do. It gives me a chance to talk it out.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, Suzanne, those those sketches of the horse farm over there. We haven't studied those. That's the one thing in there I have never got into.
You mean the one with the trip to Mr. Snyder and?
No.
The tilks.
Her portrait of the tilks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, she has seen more. Now you see, you depend on me too much for abstractions.
Yeah.
You ought to make your own and live with them. And I try not to do too much of that, you see.
Well, you see, I've depended on a teacher for that all my life.
Your abstraction is your eyes. And if you don't wrestle with that abstraction, you see, you don't see. And you're bored. And if you get into those tilt portraits, including the horses, oh Lord. The horses and the girls. That's the most substantial thing I have on tape. I don't have anything from anyone on tape that even close to that. And I haven't studied it.
Well,
and
she
I don't have
puts
a book
in
on
the details.
What?
She'll put in the details where Miss Mary or Mr. Weaver won't.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
She knows she's doing it, I think.
And that's the best thing on England that I've got. And
yes,
I've got 20 dozen books on it.
They went to England and didn't see a thing.
Not like that.
I went over there and I didn't see a thing. And look what Barbara has seen. But I don't know that she saw it over there. I think she saw it sitting here at this table.
Well, that's it. See, you have the experience yourself. But it takes a while. Like Dick has, I've never thought about Dick much, you know, other than just around and he had temper and all. But
you start to look at him.
When I started thinking about, well, how would I do it if I'm talking about it to somebody, you know, isn't it?
Yeah.
Then he comes alive for me too.
Yeah.
But.
Well, now you see where I got that. From Emily.
Yeah.
Through Anderson. Well, actually, I got it from Anderson because I can't get anything directly from Emily. You see, she said, truth comes from art. I don't use the term art. And I translate that like I do a good bit of Emerson, you see.
Mm-hmm.
By art, she meant handling it. It's not your perceptions at sea, it's the handling of your perceptions. Now that's what I got from Anderson. Now you say it's not what Anderson said, or it's not what, he doesn't get it straight what she said. It doesn't matter damn to me. That has been fruitful.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's been one of the most helpful things, and I think it's helped some of the classes. Some of the people I work with.
Well, and you tell them it's put it, like you say, if you call it art, well, they.
Yeah, that stops you.
And I think, like, you have an awful hard time ever telling somebody that Barbara's talk is art, artistic, or anything.
Yeah.
But if
yeah.
you just say she's doing something with something,
yeah.
You know, then they can. They're like, just. sitting in Dr. Picard's class on Moby Dick. I just said, he brought out all that business with Hawthorne, seemed like the first part of the book, up to chapter 22 or so, was how it was originally begun, and then Melville got in with Hawthorne, and after that, the book improved, because it got metaphysical. I thought, that's a matter of opinion.
Well, that's what you got the other night.
Yeah. No, not last. That was last month. I didn't go Monday night. I didn't make it.
Oh, didn't make it?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't hope she'd go on.
Well, I was too.
I wondered, I would have discouraged you, I'd have said, stay at home and do your own work. But you wanted to go, and I was go along with you. Faye didn't hear about your Queen Mab.
Gosh. That was last Monday. Dr. Picard, the way he runs the class, he'll give you a chapter, maybe two chapters of a book. And you just do everything you possibly can with that chapter. This is why when we studied Emily Dickinson, we were supposed to take one poem. And just see if it took you 100 pages to go through every line and every word of that poem, that's what you're supposed to do, to cover it completely. Of course, not too many people manage to do it to his satisfaction, but it's kind of fun. But anyway, the one girl had the chapter on Queen Mab, and she looked up all sorts of things. She had, the part in Romeo and Juliet, the dream, and she ended up, I think her main idea was that the dream is symbolic of the whole Moby Dick story, and that's symbolic of the journey of the soul. And Queen Mab was supposed to be oversee these nighttime journeys of the soul. She looked up some obscure Shelley poem, and I don't think even Dr. Picard had remembered it. She told him where she found it. He said, oh, yes. And she went through it. And she went through the thump, the living thump, and the dead thump, and the man with the hunchback. And just went off in about 20 different directions on that chapter. Just what it could possibly refer to, where Melville might have gotten the idea. And I listened for about 10 minutes, I guess, and then I started looking at the chapter, and that sent me off. I started looking, I read it, it's the first time, I probably read it before, but I looked at it this time, and I could see, that the universal thump in the first chapter, and then he's got the dead thump and the living thump, and all that stuff. It's fun. But everybody, in the class, they sit there, and They'll listen for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then you notice people just kind of dropping off here and there. And the girl, she just goes on, and usually real enthusiastic about her own report. She was. She'd spent a lot of time on it. And he finally got through, and Dr. Picard asked me, he says, do you think that would work for freshmen? Because that's the question I brought up, how do you get a freshman into Moby Dick without turning him off? And I said, well, no, I don't think that'd do too good. He said, well, how would you handle it, if that question came up? Why does he call a chapter Queen Mab when there's no mention of Queen Mab? And I said, it wouldn't come up. And he said, well, other than that point, what? So I told him, I said, well, if I were going to do it, I'd just tell him, that here's Ishmael talked about, why should he care if he gets knocked in the head? If the captain tells him to do something and gives him a thump, because the captain's going to get his thump. And then the dream just kind of goes through that, Why should Stubb worry about getting kicked by, a wooden leg? But anyway, later on, the last report of the night, in the class last 3 hours, a boy got up. Well, man, he'd been out of school about 3 years, T. teaching, things like that. And he started off and he said that this was his first foray into graduate school, and he didn't know how good he was going to do. That guy got hold of, he had the chapter, the GAMs they call them, meetings of the ships. And he got into his report, and you could just see heads come up. You know. And it was 9:45, and the class was over at 10, supposed to be. And he went on until 10:30. And I'd say about half the class was willing for him to keep on, because he'd read, you know. He'd read parts of his paper, and he'd read parts of Moby Dick. And he'd do it in this kind of dramatic way. You could just see kids listening to him. It was his first time. And the woman sitting next to me, the class was mostly people I had never seen before. A lot of them were teachers, you know, just in school for the summer. And this was a woman about 45 or so. And about 10:15, she finally stopped and she said, "Would you please just read the book to us?" She didn't care about his report. She just wanted him to read. Because he was, you know, he read the quarterdeck scene, parts of it. You know, like, "I'd strike the sun if it insulted me," you know, and he's a little dramatic. And he read that last scene with the whirlpool and going down and down. Everybody just, you know, I guess I followed what he was saying, most of it, once I started, you know, just realizing he was doing something a little different than everybody else. And after the class, about 3 people went up to him and said they had enjoyed his report. You know, and that just doesn't happen. And all he really said, basically, was that in the book, there's just this complete and utter ambiguity between good and evil. You think, well, the whale is this, and you think, but no, it might be this, you know, and you just don't know. You know, anything. You don't know whether Ahab's insane or whether he's, you know, divinely insane or whatever. But when he'd read, you know, this came to life for everybody. I was going to say, "Dr. Clark, well, you just need somebody like that in every class." But even Anne, you know, this was the first time she'd ever read Moby Dick. And she thought, she picked up right off that cetology business, you know, and she, because, you know, she's a librarian, so she realized he was kind of playing with that. She said, "But
oh,
he,
did she?
Oh yeah, she brought that up with me." I said something about he had a sense of humor, you know, sometimes, and she said, "Yeah, that cetology business."
Oh really?
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah.
And of course that little the frontispiece, you know, where to the sub librarian, she just laughed. It's about what she is, a sub librarian. But she said he carries it on too far. He just goes on with it too long and it gets boring.
Well, yes.
Barbara picked that up so nicely.
Yes. Barbara handled that nicely.
That was lovely.
Yeah, but he's interested in the idea of classification.
Yeah.
So he, the idea carries him through really good material. And he's not really a sense of humor. He's just treating it with a light touch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's my statement.
Yeah. I guess the language is...
You kind of go right again.
Yeah. You talk about jokes
see,
or cutting up or sense of humor. And
you see, my categories all start from Emerson. That's where I learned what a category is.
Mm-hmm.
It was just using Emerson. You see, I could see back there that conformity was no great problem with him. He was a perfect conformist, you see, himself, in his clothes, Lord, he wore black, and Star Trek, it was a fruitful idea, you see, conformity opened up what the other was. So there's your category. It's something that's truthful. It's not true. And then you can see, you know, that his first statement, you see, he who would be a man is just utter nonsense. Or, you know, ambiguity or whatever you want to call it. That's your category. But see, I have innocence. That's where I started out.
Well, Dr. Picard picks up, he'll pick up Emerson in Moby Dick, but he goes to transcendentalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just almost completely dismissed all the chapters on whaling, you know, the whole first part of the book, and all the other chapters, as just, you know, that this was a, like his other books, just an adventure story, and it was going to be a tale and nothing else. Just dismisses that, and I guess it's because he doesn't look at it in the sense that, well, like Mr. Weaver's the farming, you know. I guess Melville just kind of went into whaling with Mr. Well, I'm not sure. Well, like the haying, you know. Now I can look at that, and to me it's just kind of an adventure, or it was. And then you think of Melville, well, the whaling is probably an adventure to him, you know, and he just writes about that life. And of course, all the others part of it, somehow or other, you know, just, who, you know, how many people are going to sit there and worry about an oversoul, you know, that just, you know, most people, well, that's nice, you know, what's the point?
Uncle, you're a Frenchman. You had just a little structure to the Frenchman, Suzanne. Do you remember?
Well, just the fact that, you know, that. He couldn't put up with stupidity, and then his temper was so.
I mean, to the pants episode.
Oh yeah.
You had a little structure to it.
Yeah. Well, I just think with that, I mean, I know you don't just say, well, you had a temper, and then just let it go. You wouldn't put in an incident in the temper. That's the one I guess I remember best.
But you still have to handle it. You see, you let him go through his bag once, twice.
Yeah, in the closet, in the libo.
Yeah, and then he walks outside.
Yeah,
like,
and then out to the car, cool off.
And looks in the trunk of his car, and he knows ahead of time it's not there. See. So it's a little plot, but it's also a structure. If you use it, it's a structure. And I think Barbara has a little sense of structure.
With the episodes of Mrs. Parker, you know, with the girls, I think she does. I can see a little bit there. You know, that she, Mrs. Parker's is friends with the one she's talking to right then, but. She'll go off and all of a sudden, you know, you're the villain. That's not it exactly.
No, I think she's got, structure. Wouldn't that be nice to see that?
It'd be nice to see anything.
It would be, for sure would.
Structure.
Because I had, that's one thing that all of my friends lack, and I don't pretend to have it, you know, I'm just I'm the critical superstructure, that's all I am. I learned learned a little bit about structure from writing fiction. You have to be in one place, and the people you're talking to have to know where you stand. And you can't change places. That's confusing. If you do, you gotta wait until you read it. And I think that's one of the most helpful things. It's very simple, isn't it?
In my mind, there's a whole tape, or maybe you have to isolate it from different parts. There's enough for a whole tape on the tilt.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And more.
One
I mean, just hold that up.
Yeah, one of the finest was that day, and everybody's gone, and we were sitting here at lunch. And she talked about one of the girls. See, I haven't been in it sometime, I forget it.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked a long time about that girl. Sitting right there.
Mm-hmm. The one that she really didn't like, but she did.
True.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think, Suzanne, I think it would work backwards. I think you could find out things from this. It's not in the other tapes. And it might be that it would help do the taping. You see, if you have a sense of form yourself, you can sort of project it. And I miss out so much. See, Faye just tells me about the places where she thinks that I did nicely. But I do that sometimes. I hit it off every now and then. But you see, what I'm looking for is where I just couldn't make contact. Just couldn't. My mind wouldn't work. And I can go back over those tapes and I can see them, and it just makes me flinch. Oh, time after time after time. I can see. I sometimes I know it at the time.
Just your transition.
I just can't get, you know, my footwork's so slow.
Okay.
Now you see, you learn those things, but you see, it takes so much. I don't know. I don't want to wish it off on anyone. The taping is a considerable responsibility. You got to be pretty close to Ahab before you can do that. That's not Ishmael so much as Ahab.
Yeah, nice.
It's fierce what it takes to tape. It's fierce. You see, that whole scene of the quarterdeck is manipulated.
Yeah.
And you see that beautiful thing we got of Jim Gilbert there. His last scene moment almost, his last surge of life, we manipulated that. And it's a beautiful thing. And it took so many people, you see, to tie it up, work it out. You wouldn't work without Cookie.
Yeah.
Well, Cookie was his foil.
Cookie was his foil. It wouldn't have worked without Ms. Gilbert.
His unwilling foil. Let me see, Faye. Oh, yes. Jim, it was thought he had missed out by not getting in with Uncle Clovis over in Blueberry. That's how his name.
Uncle Eddie.
Yeah. And that's, Suzanne tried to get in on that talk. She was in between the women. The women supposed to talk together.
Oh,
but
she
stood in the middle where she could sort of hear Uncle Eddie, too.
And
yeah, you and Jim both, Uncle Eddie had that ear.
Oh, yeah. He just sat back the whole time. He's in a chair the whole time with his hat on his head. Jim just talked to him the whole time. He said just about. And of course, Jim found out he had horses. Well, they'll laugh. She said, if you let them know you know anything about horses, they're going to live over at your house. But he just, of course, View was there, and he wanted to tell everybody about his Georgia place and his plans about the cattle.
Isn't that nice?
And they were willing to help him. They'd run cattle. They knew about grass, feed, hay. You know, and they just... Joe and I are trying to somehow or other talk View out of those six efforts that they don't help a bit. They just tell them, just feed them salt. They'll eat that dead grass and water and fatten up.
And this uncle, is this the one who lives at Newberry?
Yeah, his family's lived at Newberry. He said for seven generations. And I thought, my Lord, they must go back to the Revolutionary War. Then I thought, he can't mean that. His great-grandfather came down from Georgia about 1850 or so, I think, because he was born in 1812. And they've lived over there ever since, before Newberry was even Newberry, I think. And his generations include his grandchildren now. So.
Well, golly, why haven't you been visiting?
Well, we didn't know he...
Well, that's it, you see.
You see, all he was is Uncle Eddie and Aunt Moselle, and Jim didn't know them from anybody, you know, and you just don't go around visiting people.
Jim got this one-track mind. If everything happened, he'd go into the Cape, see? His compass just got one needle on it.
He jumps me, is what he does. He says, this is other night, he's feeling bad. He said, we never do anything but go out to the ranch.
You tell me what guy's been telling you all this time. Why don't you circulate and then come back and report?
Yeah. Now, what did I tell him? You remember those things I told him?
Not right at all.
I told both of you, don't sit around here and look at me. Go over and see Miss Gusfield.
Yeah.
Uncle Tom, I'm not Newberry.
Yes, Faye, that really put View on his feet. Protein.
He says, they can't eat but a pound of that stuff. He says, and then they got to go find him something to fill up with. And they'll eat dead grass, they'll eat anything, and they'll fill up on water. And you'll have fat cows all winter. And then View came up with his idea, well, he doesn't have to keep them fat all winter. He just let them go down a little bit.
And he had that analogy?
Yeah. You drive a car up a hill, you don't get going fast and then keep up that same speed all the way up the hill. You let up a little bit on your accelerator and just go slower, you know, until you get up. You let build up some momentum and then you let up and go up the hill. Well, he's going, I guess, get his cows fat in the summer and then just let them coast through the winter up the hill. He doesn't think that they're going to be carrying a calf while they're coasting.
Right.
Slow things down a little bit.
That's right. They got a calf at the low point of the year, January. And a long ways before the grass gets green.
It's going to be a lot longer up there than it is down here. Because in March, you see, he's betting on that fescue. because it stays green all year round. And according to everybody, the best authorities, Uncle Eddie included, it stays its best in the winter, like rock. And it gets thicker and grows more in the summer, but it's not as rich as it is in the winter. So he's, you know, he's just banking on the fescue.
Now, Uncle Eddie has lived all his life at Newberry.
Yeah, he surprised Jim and I didn't know that. Well, that Jim didn't know. I was kind of on the outskirts of this. But he said that he'd ridden this open range. He said, you know, they had open range when he was six. And he's ridden, I guess like Mr. Guthrie, he's had cattle and horses until this last couple of years. And so he wanted Jim and I to come over sometime and visit, and he was going to drive us around that countryside out there and introduce us to people, his relatives that are, you know, older and younger.
Is that right?
Yeah, see?
Why, that's just perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. he wants us to come over, and he's going to drive us around, just show us around that area.
And he doesn't know what he's getting into.
No.
So you see, little by little, you can bring up each one of them, and every time you do, he'll give a little bit, like Miss Daisy. Miss Daisy has a beautiful gallery of portraits, and every time she looks at one of them, she looks at it a little different and adds a little bit to it, and it's just beautiful.
But now you see, they don't work, so we can go over there any time, and I don't have to wait for Jim, because Jim can't go till he gets his thing finished. I think, well, my Lord, how am I going to work on Barbara? Well, now I got Uncle Eddie, too. Things are just stacked against me. I can't go back to school in the fall, and we can't leave here in the fall.
Barbara's
oh,
her gallery is so rich.
Oh, it is rich.
Yeah,
oh, it's phenomenal. And she's got her school days in that. She picks up some of her school portraits. Yes.
You know that. Any of that was there.
Mm-hmm.
I know sometimes she talks about the dailies.
She has several of her North Carolina sketches and one from up here. Now, Uncle Eddie has lived all his life there.
Oh, yeah, all his life.
And he's surrounded by his kinfolks.
Yeah.
His children and his grandchildren?
Well, his cousins and uncles and just second cousins and just, you know. You see, what happened, grandfather, I think it was just a mass migration from Georgia is what it was, or something like that. See, grandfather's always lived a great deal of time over in Stark or in Newberry. And most of his family was originally centered in that Newberry area, and they branched out a little bit. But there are still several in their 40s or so that are still cattle ranching, you know, run cattle and stuff. And then, of course, from the reunion, there were three, I think, that are still in the cattle. And then, of course, there's people on his wife's side and people that don't come to the reunion, just his relatives all over the place. And friends, of course, too. And he lived there all his life, and his father lived there all his life. And his grandfather, great-grandfather, a good deal of the time. So.
So he goes way back.
Yeah. I guess he's in his, I'd say his late 60s.
And seems to be, have some vigor?
Yeah. He kept. He sold his cattle and horses. You know, he's not active like that now. But up until, I think last year, he was still riding.
Well,
I mean, he's not.
He'd
not
get
dull.
Out of the cattle business for other reasons too. You see that things are so difficult now.
Yeah, we see now he's got his land in Pine.
Yes.
The government plants it, and all he does is watch it or something.
That's right, and he can make more than that if it doesn't work again.
I guess. He's got 300 acres.
Oh, this is so great. Let's put stuff up. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. You know, when I was your age, I had contact with the families, all sorts of beautiful, nice families. And see, I didn't know how to work with them, and they didn't either. And that's sad, isn't it? But now, I don't know what it is. Every now and then, somebody comes along, like Catherine Ann Porter and the other woman. Several of the Southern women in particular, you see, who are just full of these things we're talking about. And they can see.
Yeah.
And, the academic side has been so overworked. A little of it's nice. I used to think up in Kentucky, they needed to come to school till they got in my class and had a little glimpse of Emerson. And that put them on their own. And then just somehow or other quit cramming. And wherever they were, it didn't matter where they were, they would. See, they'd go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But now, of course, the institutions had to, by institutions, I mean the law and the transportation, all those things had to, like Whitman said, it's the institutions that make you. And see, right now, Suzanne, it seems to me that all the institutions trip you. If you want to have any feeling at all, you see, for the, like Mrs. Rowan, none of them work in that direction. You see, full employment, everybody you come in contact with in your family or Jim's family will be willing to hire you out.
Yeah.
Under the badge of full employment. It's not anything personal.
Yeah.
Or they're not using you, or, you know, actually hiring you out, that's a bad word.
It's just people want to get jobs.
And furthermore, you'd think it's right too. You see, you just
sort of a badge of success. You've got a good job.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, in order to counter that, you've got to figure out something that'll protect you. Jack Long told me one thing. He said he could do any damn thing he pleased. He's a Shakespeare scholar, you know. Barbara's that, ain't he? As long as he called it research. And it's magic.
That's what she's, that's how she got Stay of the Conscious this summer. She's doing research.
I got mine.
Research.
Well, I mean, you know.
That's why I write my letter, you see.
Yes.
Because
it doesn't matter what it is. You can research in cow dumplings. Yes, so it's research. Well, now I'm not telling you what the antidote is, but to protect yourself against full employment, you
you got to do research. Well, you see, that's why Sloan is taking pictures of Barnes this summer. He simply was not going to hire out, and face that, and the family agreed, and they all thought it was wonderful. Even Don said that's the stupidest thing that ever was, to have Ronald go do a little craftsman job in order to buy groceries when he needs to lie fallow this summer.
Yes.
But to salve his conscience, he's taking pictures of Barnes.
Yes. And when Fay was down here, I was at the stage, we went around and studied Gates.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at Gates at Newberry and Latchford. But that's and it was through that that I realized for the first time, I never read in the book, that the 19th century was concrete. Emerson is actually concrete. I've never faced that. I don't know whether I could maintain that or not, but Thoreau is concrete, and They're all concrete. And your novelist that you read with Mr. Helston, they are.
That's the end of the Suzanne second session, this Thursday, the 5th of August, 1971. This is the end of the second session, this Thursday, the 5th of August, 71. This is the end of the second session, this Thursday, the 5th of August, 71. Now, I think this channel 2 over, but I'm not sure. It's around 800, channel 2 over. Channel, around 800, channel 2 over.